Now, what then about the changes in the actual setting in which cultural activity took place? How cultural activity was practiced and in theory in our period from roughly 1700 to 1850. And that, of course, is again connected to something that we have stressed all along, that to the bourgeois quest for self-definition, for identity. And here you have read Tom Brown already, but I must say something about the Moyne concept, which became so closely and intimately attached to bourgeois life in Germany and Central Europe, elsewhere as well. The concept of Bildung, which I spelled to you on the board, which was really a further definition of the non-aristocratic side by side with the Christian gentleman in England, and yet different from it in some respects. The concept of Bildung, which is essential really, emerged roughly between 1750 and 1770. For Bildung was not at first based so much on the religious revivals, which we've talked about, then about the Enlightenment, a concept of self-cultivation, largely self-cultivation through the classics. The attitude came not as in England through the chapel, but from learning. And at the essence center of it was an Enlightenment concept, the concept of the autonomous personality. It was based, moreover, on reason, all these Enlightenment ideas, classics, reason, the autonomous personality, the idea of self-cultivation over against the aristocratic idea or the ideas of the lower classes. But this, the center of it, is not only the classics, but something else again, which we've talked about often enough, and which I now want to make explicit, namely this strange preference, as it may have seemed to you, of the 19th century for the aesthetic. The idea that artistic form reflects the harmony of man and the universe. The preoccupation with man as a creator, with man as a creative human being, which comes from the Enlightenment, really, and properly speaking, and which is part of this autonomy of man, which is part of the way of the bourgeoisie to reach out, if you like, towards higher things from the material pursuit. Man is a creator. Now, you've seen that reflected, I think, in nationalism, in the idea of beauty, in the symbolism, in the Greek revival, and all that meant. But you always have the idea here of beauty and harmony as forming the mind, with Schiller's famous essay on the aesthetics of education. On and on, you can cite a great many sources for this at the beginning of the century. The greatest influence in Germany came from England, from Shaftesbury in England. That is to say, the identity of harmony and art and virtue. That identity of harmony and art, as exemplified by the Greeks, and virtue, which again fuses with the symbolism of outward form, at least to a certain extent. This kind of identity you have. And the second great source is Émile, which after all you read, Rousseau's Émile. But I can sum it up again by a German source, the writer Wieland at the end of the 18th century, that the Greeks had good taste, healthy reason, and good manners. So it was all tied up in this concept of building. Good taste, which meant by and large classical taste. It's going to mean more in a minute, but at the beginning it meant classical taste. Reason of the Enlightenment and good manners. All things that we have discussed, but that the concept of Bildung brings, as it were, together. You will notice, of course, that the goal here is very similar to Tom Brown. Self-control. A distinguishing marks beyond the feudal structure, if you like. The building of an elite through the idea of, through this ideal. And it all comes together in the founding, as I've told you once before, of the new University of Berlin in 1810, after which all other universities, including this University of Wisconsin, are eventually modeled. Because part of this concept of Bildung is the concept of academic freedom, of the non-interference of the state, because it is an ideal of self-cultivation. And the University of Berlin was the first university which got, if you what you would call, academic freedom in this regard. Now, here again then, the bourgeois was defining itself. The liberal idea of freedom links, obviously, with this idea of freedom, of self-cultivation in education. They are all one, if you like. Defining itself, respectability is a part of that. Good manners is an integral part of this concept of Bildung. But the content of Bildung was going to widen. And it widens to take in not only the classics, but what we would call the newest in art and literature at the beginning of the 19th century, the Romantic movement. It widens and it becomes, as it were, extremely diffuse and sentimental. And eventually it does link with the state, in spite of academic freedom, through Romanticism, through stressing more and more the emotions as a content rather than reason. And classics, in the end, become something quite different than intended, a kind of rote learning, a kind of rote learning. And the emotions come to be contained in that new literature of Romanticism, which becomes an incipient, dangerous kind of irrationalism. Now, this newest of literature penetrated the concept of Bildung through a unique kind of constellation, cultural setting and constellation. That is to say, the salons or drawing rooms, certain salons or drawing rooms at the beginning of the 19th century, where people of all classes, by which I mean bourgeoisie and aristocracy, of course, and all faiths, Jews and Christians, met to discuss the newest in literature. And the newest in literature was the Romantic literature and the newest in art. These were, so to speak, extraterritorial. And that becomes, of course, a hallmark of the avant-garde. Always extraterritorial places of discussions. And this was the first one, presided over by what you would call outsiders. These remarkable women, Henrietta Hertz and Rachel Levine in Germany above all, who were double outsiders, women and Jews, and who had great conflicts, both as women and as Jews, but who overcame their lack of emancipation by founding these meeting places where all these intellectuals, as we would say today, met, as it were. For them, it was a step to assimilation. Both as Jews, they got baptized by and large, but also as women. It was really the first kind of assertion in the cultural marketplace of women as determining culture, or rather determining the avant-garde. But in this cultural setting, you can see what Peter Gay, in another connection in the Weimar Republic, has called the outsider who became an insider. But that is the fate of the avant-garde. It is always first outsiders, and eventually it is co-opted, and the outsider becomes an insider. This is what happened to all of these. And Romanticism, of course, soon became an inside thing and no longer an outside thing at all. But you can see in these salons something else as well, which points to the future. The intellectual as regarding himself in a way as a pioneer of the new, as a conscience of society, as having a view of totality. You can see it here, because these salons spread to France and England as well. They did not remain a typical German phenomena anyhow. Now, as court society gave way to bourgeois society, you have then this bourgeois quest of self-definition in Bildung, or in the kind of education of Tom Brown in England. But you also have a kind of transitional period. And the transitional period are these salons. This is the transition from aristocratic culture to bourgeois domination of culture, from an aristocratic court setting to, if you like, a middle class setting. Now, it is transitional because its place was soon taken, partly by a revival of older institutions, the coffee house in Central Europe, the club in England, all older institutions now revived, or if you like, taken over for middle class cultural activity, together with journals and publishers. A kind of explosion of journals and publishers, after all, which takes part in the 19th century, ever more, ever greater, that I think we have mentioned already. Now, I can summarize this by saying it this way, that the bourgeois lifestyle was constantly expanding, taking over more and more of the tools of cultural dissemination, old tools, and in the salons for a while creating new tools as a transitional phenomenon. But in the concept of Bildung really creating its goal. And so you get constantly a phenomena that I have already discussed with Marx with you, that it becomes part of what in Germany indeed is one word, Bildungsbürgertum, the Bildungsbürgertum. And the Bildungsbürgertum reaches out for higher things. If you read an important novel at the end of the century like Fontana's Jenny Tribal or Thomas Mann's novel, you will see the bourgeois constantly reaching out for higher things, trying to get out of its cage of material activity, of course, both through institution of festivals, bourgeois festivals towards the end of the century, ritualized birthdays and so on. But the matter here is that, to sure, the bourgeois got its own festivals, birthdays, Christmas, Easter, a regular rhythm of festivals in the bourgeois family, which you don't find before. And festivals were a way of getting out again the cage of bourgeois life. But as the century wore on, like all aspects of bourgeois life, and this was its strength in the way, these things become ritualized, formalized, like a bourgeois dinner party, or a bourgeois tea party, or the bourgeois festivals, where there is always a recitation of poetry, and so on. They all have their rhythms, and the rhythms are set. So that the only escape really was to reach out for higher things. But these higher things were no longer the classics so much, which people had in school and had reacted unfavorably against as they had become rote learning, but largely reaching out for some kind of sentimentality, some kind of romanticism, and in the end, of course, fusing this with nationalism and all sorts of other ideas. Just as the bourgeoisie expanded its lifestyle in other ways, of which many could be mentioned. One I'll mention quickly are the bathing places, the spas, where people went to drink waters like Carlsbad or Marienbad in Czechoslovakia, but which were really bourgeois marriage markets, because there was no way to sell your daughter properly except this way. So the spas, that's why Europe is full of them, the watering places, really became bourgeois marriage markets, and the health became totally secondary in Karlsbad and Marienbad and in all of those kind of places. So you have the lifestyle always expanding. Now this bourgeois lifestyle, I think, sums up much of what we have analyzed. The Enlightenment emphasis on reason and always on restraint, on the autonomy of man, on progress. But at the same time, the lifestyle becomes, as the concept of Bildung, which really defines it in a way, that lifestyle becomes more and more undermined, if you like, by romanticism, idealism, the emotions, though always restraint, the reaching out to nature in order to break open the kind of bourgeois cage. So you have that too towards the end of the century. The most industrialized country, England, discovers Switzerland. The rush to the Alps is an English affair. Zermatt, the Matterhorn, all the Swiss places were discovered in the 1890s and really founded by Englishmen from the most advanced bourgeois society. Others then, of course, joined in. Or let us say in Germany, and it becomes ritualized, the Sunday walk of the family. Father, mother, and the children all go for a Sunday walk. And in my youth still, the landscape in France and Germany was dotted with these places where there were signs, here families can cook their own coffee. Here können Familien Kaffee kochen. People can cook their own coffee, because the Sunday walk became ritualized. And indeed, you could say the rediscovery of the Alps became ritualized as well, eventually. It all becomes, in a way, ritualized, but it is this reaching out which you have here. We come back again to something I said last time, the reaching out for what we might call immutabilities again. Sort of substitute religions, protecting you against the rapid change, which I illustrated last time with railway travel, but which, of course, at the end of the century speeded up considerably. The ordered process, the whole concept of Bildung, more and more becomes integrated in the reaching out to what people think are these kind of immutabilities, nationalism, romanticism, nature, and less a reason, in a way. But at the same time, towards the end of the 19th century, that you have the formation of all the things that we've discussed of bourgeois civilization. A double revolution takes place, quite distinct from each other. On the one hand, there is the socialist alternative, which towards the end of the century, after all, becomes important. But the socialist alternative adopts the bourgeois lifestyle. That is to say, it is a revolution that is social and economic, but that is not directed against culture, that accepts the idea of Bildung, accepts the idea of respectability, and all of this. But there is a second revolution, a cultural revolution, that takes place. And this cultural revolution is a matter of bourgeois children revolting against their bourgeois parents. It is what one might call the anti-bourgeois bourgeois revolution. And this is a cultural revolution. And this is a revolution against morals and manners. And it has a name. It calls itself the avant-garde. The avant-garde revolution of the expressionists, the impressionists, the Ibsen, the realists, yes? And many like Wedekind's Spring Awakening, which you may have seen produced here 2 years ago, the play which reached out for varieties of sexual experience. In other words, what you have is the avant-garde. But between the two revolutions, there will be no connection. And that will have very serious consequences. It means, in the end, something that we are all familiar with, that socialist revolution tends to be petit bourgeois in its extreme. That is to say, tends to accept and mimic the bourgeois, and never had any relationship to modern art or modern literature at all. The workers' movement had no relation to modern art and modern literature. And on the other hand, the avant-garde could get very little relation to the workers' movement. And while the workers' movement was interested in social and economic change, but not cultural change, the bourgeois children were interested in cultural change, but not in social and economic change. And so you get this very important division, I think, in the end, which is, will be lasting, between the cultural revolution and the avant-garde and the social and economic revolution. A very important kind of division, which will explain to you why socialist art is so crude, so unimportant, because it had no relationship to modern art, no relationship to the avant-garde. It condemned it, as all socialist congresses condemned it in the 1890s. But with all of this, of course, what about the systems of thought that we have studied? Hegel, Rousseau, those systems of thought that reached out for a totality. Now, I would say that these systems of thought, in the end, provided especially Hegel and Rousseau to a certain extent, came to provide a kind of alternative in between the avant-garde and the workers' movement, a kind of different kind of alternative. And because an alternative with different kind of revolutionary implications, with open structures instead of the closed structures of socialism on the one hand and bourgeois life on the other. So that is why I have always told you that you must not make Hegel's dialectic, you must not connect it too closely to the old Hegel, the Hegel who saw the end of the dialectic in the state, because in a sense the future of Hegel is precisely in his open-endedness. And when you get, therefore, this alternative, reviving after 1918, as I have told you, I think, before, and when it becomes the hallmark of what we might call the left-wing intellectuals, then after 1918, first in Germany, and then after the Second World War only in France and other countries, when you get the revival of Hegelianism, certain amount of Rousseau as well, it becomes, in fact, an alternative, what I called, I think, last time or the time before, the kind of socialism of the intellectuals. It becomes a kind of alternative, if you like, to the closed structures of the workers' movement and of bourgeois life. and it leads to something only sporadically, namely a kind of fusion of the avant-garde and social and economic revolution. But even there, that fusion is at best an uneasy fusion, both in that revival that we might call the Frankfurt School, because it was done by certain academics in Frankfurt in the late 1920s, and by others like Lukács and others. They also tended in the end to be conservative, so that you have the continuous cultural problem of the avant-garde being divorced from social and economic change, even for those intellectuals, even for what we might call eventually the new left, which, after all, clung on the one hand to a definition of art which was banal in the extreme, and on the other hand to ideas of sexual respectability. So in the end you get that same idea that there is really no great connection between what we might call the avant-garde in culture and changing society, that these things have not been connected, even when Hegel and Rousseau, to a less extent, became, as it were, a alternative. Now, all of this, I think, explains to a certain extent why bourgeois society has been so successful, and why the concept of Bildung, which grew up, after all, at the end of the 18th century, has been a lasting concept in society to this day, of course. The concept of Bildung and the essence of the concepts even that you have in Tom Brown. The co-optation of all movements by bourgeois society has certainly been characteristic. For bourgeois society has co-opted the avant-garde, I don't have to illustrate to you that what is avant-garde at one time becomes in the next. It has always co-opted the avant-garde. The expressionists, however revolutionary, become in the other day, in today. You should try and buy one of them these days. You couldn't afford it. Nobody could. In other words, it always is co-opted. It becomes in a way, but in becoming co-opted, the revolutionary sting is drawn. Now, for much of the rebellion that I've told you about, the First World War already drew the revolutionary sting. These young people experienced camaraderie, they came to the nation, they reached out for community, and many expressionists became tamed. On the other hand, the avant-garde of the 1920s was also eventually tamed. And on the other end of the spectrum, the workers' movement was integrated straight away, certainly into bourgeois culture, and eventually, of course, it became ever more gradual and became, in fact, integrated into bourgeois society, as the workers' movement today is a part of bourgeois society in every way. So that this co-optation has been extremely strong. And perhaps, again, I can summarize it best, again, through the sexual urges and angles of this matter, that is to say, the prevailings of respectability. If I quote to you the most famous sexologist of his time, much more famous than Freud, until after the First World War, Krafft Ebing, and if I quote to him from 1907, and if you remember, or if I tell you, that Krafft Ebing was a progressive. He was a progressive in his time. He founded, in a way, a scientific idea of sexuality, a scientific investigation of sex, but not in the way of health and sickness, as those doctors we talked about who became the guardians of sex in the 19th century, but rather in order to understand it, not to condemn it, to understand it. And in order to understand sexual deviance as congenital, as inherited. And still, with all of this, Krafft Ebing defines a civilized human being. Now this, the definition of a civilized being that from Krafft Ebing really sums up in a way the whole package, you know, that we've put together here, tried to put together of what we call the bourgeois lifestyle. The civilized human being, writes Krafft Ebing, must under all circumstances be able to master his sexual urges as soon as they come into conflict with the altruistic demands of society. If the normally constituted civilized being were not capable of fulfilling this demand, then family and the state as the foundations of legal and civic community could not exist. The basis, therefore, of the existence of family, the state, community, law is being civilized. And civilized is self-control. Civilized is restraint. This has been a theme throughout, ever since we've dealt with the Enlightenment, and here put straightly in the control of the sexual urges. Now, what we have done, I think, is clear, but I want to make, I hope it is clear, but I want to make it quite explicit again. From many different strands in the 18th century, we have put together the bourgeois lifestyle we all take for granted. And I hope that throughout this discussion, you have learned that all these ideas, the supremacy of the nation, the state, the family, the virtues of duty, hard work, fair play, the idea always of self-control, and then the reaching out for the so-called higher things in life, always vaguely defined as romantic, usually romantic novels, romantic literature, the ritualization of life, that all of this has definite historical origins. That when God came down and gave Moses the tablets of the law, he didn't give Moses an extra tablet of the law, saying you must be respectable, you must have duty and hard work, you must control your sexual urges, which Moses certainly did not, by the way, very well. You have in all of Abraham, not at all. So what you have therefore here is something different, something new. And I can illustrate it again by making something clear to you that if today we see all we read, or the average person, reads about the 16th and 17th century in the historical novels and sees it on television, then it is a kind of pornography for us, a kind of high-level pornography that it is made out. Most of the historical pornographic novels are set in the 16th and 17th century before you have. This is how it seems to us today, loose living, as it were. And we take it for granted that our lifestyle today is the kind of lifestyle that has always existed. But I hope that you realize now that this is far from the truth, and that the lifestyles are put together out of diverse kinds of building blocks, each one of which has a definite historic source, and each one of that has a definite historical reason for being, that therefore, in a sense, everything is relativized. Everything is history. And the explanation is not that our lifestyle is, as I said, come down on Mount Sinai, but rather that why has it lasted so long? That the questions to ask is a historical question. The rest is theology. You're welcome to theology, but it's not my business here to make theological statements. So that if you are a historian, and then you believe that everything is history. Now, depending on what happens in cultural history, you have to set the emphases. You have to set the emphases. So the emphasis for this section of cultural history was on the growth of the bourgeois lifestyle. But the emphasis on 514, that is the continuing of this cultural history, would not, I think, be on that. I think the emphasis would be on the Cultural Revolution, on the attempted cultural revolutions. It would not be on the bourgeois lifestyle. It would be on the avant-garde. It would be on the avant-garde. It would be on this attempted revolution. It would be on all the attempts to get out of the golden cage, if you like, of bourgeois life. We have set this emphasis because it seemed that this was the most important or crucial thing, not only in culture, I think, overall, of what was happening. And again, it was so crucial because you must avoid something which you're often subject to, because people like their life simple and they like their history simple. And when they like their history simple, they become economic and social determinist. Then everything is capitalism, whatever that might be, and everything is class, whatever that might be. But unfortunately, things are not that simple. And as we have seen with all that we've done and with the bourgeois lifestyle, things are filtered through people's perception. And capitalism is what people perceive it to be. And a social class is what people perceive class to be, by which I don't mean that they aren't what Marx called objective reality. Of course there's objective reality, but objective reality is not something simple, not something simple that you can say people act that way because they are of that class. That is the crudest kind of Kautsky and Engels, the crudest kind. And very comforting, because then things fall nicely into pigeonholes. But in reality, things are, of course, much more complex. And it is always the mediations that count, as I have told you before. How are things mediated? How do people perceive it? And that is, again, why we have dwelt so much in myths and symbols. Because people perceive things through myths and symbols. They put themselves into a continuity. They want to integrate themselves with something. They don't want to stand naked to face their God, as it were. They don't want to stand naked. They want to get clothes on. They want to integrate themselves. They want to reach out for this or the other. So that I think it must be quite clear that if you have these ideas, towards positivism. And even historians these days are positivists. There are some who think that the computer can solve all historical problems. I think it's a very valuable tool, this quantification, and I wish I had learned it once. I think every historian should learn how to make the tool, but it's only a tool. Because when all is said and done, and I come back to that again, everything in history is necessarily subjective. Everything really depends on how good the brain of the historian is through which it has to pass. There are no objective criteria here, or very few at any rate. And you cannot substitute economic and social determinism, and you cannot substitute a crude positivism of quantification for the historian's own skill of analysis. In the last resort, it depends how much you trust the historian's knowledge and the historian's skill of interpretation. All humanities and history is not a social science. That's a lot of nonsense. History is an art. It's a humanities. All humanities are subjective, because in the end it has to be communicated, either in writing or in language. And if you've ever written a book, you will see how much temptation there is to make a beautiful sentence rather than a beautiful truth. So what you have, therefore, here, I think is quite clear. It is subjective in the way you, but it is a subjectivity that is controlled by your facts and data. I'm not denying that. But in the last resort, it is a kind of way of thinking, a kind of skill. And the most one can teach you in these courses, where you will forget most of the content, I'm sure, most of the facts, the most one can teach you is a way of thought, a way of looking of things, a way of perceiving, a way of organization of things, which I hope the final has done. And above all again, a way of looking at the totality of things. And here I think, again, Hegel is very important. A way of looking at the totality of things, so that you realize in your own mind that everything that you take it for granted is relative. Because in the last resort, and I said that in my first lecture, you've forgotten that, the last resort, the important thing a historian must do is destroy myths. Is destroy your myths, to make you, in fact, confront yourself naked. I said that when I still taught freshmen all these years, I used to startle them by saying that the success of this course will be assured by the suicides that come after that, that come at the end. I have to do, the all best thing we can do for you, I think, is teach you to have a ruthlessly critical mind, to take nothing for granted. Nothing for granted, which is, of course, quite impossible, but to approximate this, to take nothing for granted and to see through the myths. And so that in this course, I hope, you have seen how our own lifestyle was constructed, the bourgeois lifestyle, what we call the Bildungsbürger in German, but which is generalized, this idea of building this self-definition in the bourgeoisie. And that in that sense, in this segment of cultural history, we have been in at the creation of something that is lasting. If you take 514, and I hope you will take 514 next semester and go on, then you will see how people try to rebel against this lifestyle. How, in other words, modern cultural configurations tried to be revolutionary. Though, unfortunately, I've already told you now that it's a revolution that won't come off. But I think that is, in a way, neither here nor there. It is still the beginning of patterns of modern culture, which you should know and you should understand in order to live, after all, a meaningful life. So that I haven't really trained your tastes. If I were to teach 514 again, I would train your tastes to modern art, and modern literature, and modern music, because they all fall in place, as it were, as part of this kind of revolution. And one should understand them. But perhaps in this segment, I have succeeded in doing, and that's fine with me, is to make you better bourgeois. Because I certainly am an excellent example. I am what is called a happy bourgeois. I enjoy it. You don't have to enjoy it, but revolution, I think you will learn next time. Well, please hand then, the graduate students, please put their things here, and the rest hand them to Barry. Yes? Thank you.